And now,
from the didgeridoo to 140 miles east of Kalamazoo, at least as far as Google Maps says, this version is a tribute to Motown.
Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
We'll care about this show again once we move to the Odyssey Radio Network. All right. Hey, welcome, everybody. Oh, dear. Did that pick up on the recording?
Yeah, I don't know.
I am Pierre Delecto coming at you from Los Angeles, California. And from the Motor City, Detroit, Michigan. It's the Motor City Madman, Dean Haglund. How are you, Dean?
Very good. And your pronunciation of the French version of Detroit, very accurate.
Very,
you know, when the voice
first. Very, very accurate. I don't know why. Yeah, I guess you're right about that. But I just, accuracy in my French pronunciation is not really something I ever gave two wits about. Which explains why I was a solid B student in French.
Right? Yeah, don't forget that. So, awesome. Yes, here we are. It is a snowy, snowy day. The polar vortex has come early here to the Great Lakes region. We are inundated with the white fluff coming down from the sky. And there is nothing but... Christmas cards out every window.
That's what people do right. In cold weather. They hang Christmas cards out the window there?
No, I'm saying it looks exactly like you would imagine a picture-perfect Christmas card here before Thanksgiving.
See, this is the kind of thing that the good folks who listen to the Odyssey Radio Network will be saved from listening to. Because we're going to be on a hard and fast time requirement on that show.
What?
So we won't waste, you know, 3-4 minutes at the off the top.
Yes, we will.
Well, I drink a cup of coffee and try to wake myself.
Oh my gosh. Should we be moving the time of the show recording too, so it's not where you're all hungover from Sunday night?
Welcome to our production meeting, all about the move to Odyssey Radio Network. In case you haven't heard, we have a new home starting on December 2nd, Monday, December 2nd. Usually we try to get this show to you 9-ish a.m. Monday morning Pacific time.
Right.
9 p.m. Eastern, we will be streaming live on Odyssey Radio Network. And then approximately 4 hours thereafter, I feel that that is a number that is both specific and something I am utterly making up.
I think so too.
Yeah, it's so specific it can't be true.
That's right.
But a matter of hours later, the good folks there will make the podcast version of that very show available wherever good podcasts can be found. So
right.
Monday, December 2nd, very, very exciting. And we'll be sending out some announcements this week about it.
Yeah.
Today is actually Veterans Day.
Oh, right.
And
we call it Remembrance Day back in Canada.
Now, is it on the same day? I think it is. Is it?
Yeah. The armistice of World War I is how we celebrate it.
And remembrance, you remember All those brave Americans that kept Canada free again and again and again through the years.
Little bit off. It's we remember Canadians in Canada, but yeah, sure. However, you want to see it.
That's that kind of dogged determination on the part of Canadians that has kept them free in conflict after conflict. Sure, however you want to see it. I can't be sure this is true. In fact, I'm probably sure that it isn't. But I'm going to say that we commemorated Veterans Day last year by counting down our all-time favorite war movies.
Oh,
is that possible that we did that?
That is very possible.
Well, I mean, we did do such a show. I have a feeling that we completely do not plan things enough to know that it would have been appropriate on Veterans Day Monday.
Right. But I think our number one war movie was The General, Buster Keaton. Not realizing that comedy.
Hey,
was
yeah,
actually
way to say, here's a reason you don't need to ever listen to that show.
Well, no, I'd be curious to how we got to there.
If it was our Veterans Day show, it was a great, great show. And everyone would be well advised to listen to it.
I'll go find it.
Yeah, I'm almost sure that it isn't. Yeah, it wasn't. It wasn't. It wasn't that show. Okay, I have my verification. So we're just going to, for the purposes of this show, we're going to pretend that we commemorated Veterans Day last year by doing that. Dean, how are you in your life? Jesus, should I just scrub the first seven? What are we? We're packing up. We're almost out the door. We're not getting the security deposit back.
I'm enjoying this wander. This wander through your drunken mind.
What in the world are you going to be doing today to commemorate Veterans Day?
Well, you know, as one supports the troops, one also has to support a bathroom renovation. So I will be putting in floor joists. And every joist I put in, I will think about all the service of the men and women of all of the military branches around the world. In that, I'm renovating a bathroom today.
Well, I mean, I guess I don't know. I there's no way I can put a positive spin on that at all.
What are you talking about?
And I will honor. I will honor Canadians by observing Remembrance Day, where I remember all the times Canadians have let me down. Okay.
Okay, list them.
Good, good. Well, there was that time when I hoped that newly minted American citizen Dean Haglund would... anyway, look, I... We'll be probably talking about this as a live event of the week next week. I'm going to honor Veterans Day by attending a production of Rant and Rave at the Electric Theater, the home of Rogue Machine out there in Santa Monica. Maybe it's Venice, California, where I performed when I did a Rant and Rave with the theme of Shatter back in, I think it was March of this very year. And tonight, it's all performers, I believe, who were veterans of the U.S. Armed Forces.
Oh, look at that.
Including our dear friend Tucker Smallwood.
Wow.
So that is what I'm going to do. And
I see. So you just threw me under the bus and that I had no plans just in order to announce that you're going to a show.
No, I gave you the opportunity to regale us with how there is no city in this country more patriotic, more red, white, and blue than the Motor City. And that you immersing yourself in the culture of that city would certainly be taking part. It was a chance to celebrate not only our veterans, but your new home of Detroit.
Well,
See what I did there? I not only threw you under the bus, I just backed the bus up.
You did. The bus you didn't even know potentially you drive. Is there a lot of patriotic Remembrance Day activities in Detroit? You don't know.
Let's back up and say there is, and then drive forward while Dean's still laying there. Stunned, but still alive. Okay, great. 10 minutes into the show, and we've yet to begin. This is not at all what people... I mean, we are going to come out guns blazing on Odyssey Radio Network. Right now, I feel the people at Odyssey are listening to this going, is it too late? Is it too late to back out? Hey, you know what? We have some celebrity deaths, two from this past week, and one that took place 4 months ago, and we'd never discussed it, and ordinarily I would just let it slide, but it is someone with an X-Files connection, so I think we really ought to discuss it.
Sure.
Celebrity deaths.
Do you remember the recognizable character actor Billy Drago, Dean Haglund?
Billy? Oh, yes, that's such a familiar name. Why do I recognize him?
Well, he's probably his biggest hit in terms of films. I mean, he was always a bad guy in stuff.
Yes.
But on film, he made quite the, quite the indelible mark by playing Al Capone's henchman, Frank Nitti. The pure white suit, very angel of death. In the Oscar-winning 87 movie, The Untouchables.
Right.
Funny story about that I actually read. His mother never, not Frank Nitti, Billy Drago's mother, never quite forgave him for killing Sean Connery in that movie. So, such a fan of Sean Connery was she, and she never forgave him. And he would like always say, "Mom, I had to. They paid me."
Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, so I mentioned the X-Files. He was Ori Peaty in the 7th season episode Thief.
Oh yes,
perfect.
Of course,
perfect actor for that kind of show. He had over 100 film and TV credits throughout his career, including Clint Eastwood's Pale Rider, TV series Charmed, and also played a bad guy on what I think was truly underrated, truly underappreciated. I'm not alone in that, but apparently I'm too alone for it to have been a hit. The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr.
Briscoe County Jr. I know. That was such a great show out of Vancouver. A lot of my friends working on that. Highly acclaimed and yet did not find traction somehow.
He played John Bly, one of the great bad guys there. Sinister, Bruce Campbell, the star of the show, the titular Briscoe County, unless I'm mistaken.
Right.
Bruce Campbell said of Billy Drago, he was sinister and understated on screen, sweet and humble off screen. Again, one of these guys that we talk about who made a whole career of playing villains, and everything that I've read about him was that he was just the most sweet and sensitive guy. And that is often the way, as we talk about, right? These actors who play villains are able to do so not only because they have their personal shit together in terms of how they treat their fellow human beings, but I would imagine that playing villains helped them keep their heads on right, because it gives you the opportunity to explore that ugliness, that badness that is within all of us, and put it to use for the purposes of entertaining and delighting and educating and moving people. And once you realize that all those parts of you, not only the good parts, but the bad parts and the so-called ugly parts, can find expression and be of use, i.e. in the name of something larger than yourself, boy, it's a very healthy feeling to have.
Right. The expression of your shadow, as you often say.
Do I often say that? Well, and how interesting that he would play, this would come up while he was playing a character named Bly, because after all, it was the great poet Robert Bly who wrote really one of the important books on the subject of the shadow, A Little Book of the Human Shadow. So there we go. I also, I don't know if you ever watched this, and I feel like I should remember because we talked about it when we passed through the town where it was shot there in Washington. But did you ever watch Northern Exposure?
Oh, I sure did. I love that show.
Yeah. Do you remember the character of Ed, who was an aspiring filmmaker? Young
yes,
guy, an aspiring filmmaker, yeah, on the show. I always would watch that show and think to myself, man, if anybody ever needed to cast someone to play like a young Billy Drago in flashback scenes, wouldn't that kid have been great? Darren E. Burrows was that actor's name. Wouldn't he have been spectacular to play the young him, you know, because you always see actors cast to play the young ones, and boy, films can fall apart really quickly if it doesn't pass the eyeball test immediately.
Right.
And, well, there's a reason that he would pass the eyeball test immediately. Turns out he was Billy Drago's son.
Hilarious.
So.
Well, you got me on that one.
they got both of us, Dean. Thank God, both of us. All right, Billy Drago. A great novelist, Ernest Gaines, died this week at 86. He was the celebrated author of such books as A Lesson Before Dying, and really one of my favorites, The Autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman.
Oh.
Ernest Gaines was born on a plantation in Louisiana, made his way to California as a teenager because the local high school did not allow African-American students. After serving in the Army, he earned a place in Stanford University's creative writing program, and his novels always took an honest, poetic look at the Black struggles in America. He gained some success with that autobiography of Jane Pittman, but even more when his 93 novel, A Lesson Before Dying, was featured in Oprah Winfrey's book club.
Right.
So that was a big deal for him. Both were adapted into actually quite excellent movies. Ernest Gaines, dead at 86.
Wow. Okay.
Now, have you been watching Marvelous Mrs. Maisel?
Yes, of course.
Oh, you have? We've never spoken of this. Why?
Have we not?
No, I don't think we have. I mean, my old friend Alex Borstein, so good on that show.
Yes.
Of course, Lily's dear friend Maren Hinkle, so wonderful. Is that we've never discussed it. I've only ever watched an episode and a half of it. That's all.
Are you kidding?
Yeah.
Why stopped you?
I don't know. It's Amazon, and I don't like their functionality.
Their functionality.
Yeah.
Where you...
They have not even perfected the streaming service thing to the functional standpoint of Netflix. But anyway, that's a haphazard excuse because I do watch Man in the High Castle. So, but I do just find myself, I will say, I do find myself, for whatever reason, leaning away from Amazon shows. I never have watched Mozart in the Jungle.
Well, perhaps you should get a Roku box. You ever thought of that? Because that can host both your Netflix and your Amazon Prime.
I have a Roku box.
Well, then we just stick your Amazon Prime channel onto there, and that functionality is far better than trying to watch it on your laptop.
Tell me about the Roku. Well, I always watched it through Blu-ray player on the big TV. Yeah, that's what I'm saying, is that the functionality is just not as good.
Well, probably through a Blu-ray player, yeah.
Well, it's their site. I mean, it's not, it's just not. Would you, so no, you're telling me that the Amazon portal, the Amazon Prime streaming portal is as easy, as pleasing as the Netflix portal?
I'm saying it is. If you get that on your Roku,
okay,
instead of sticking it on the website, I'm just going through your Amazon where you shop and then watch TV.
It's not that. It's the same. There's so many devices. I could watch it on the direct to the TV. I don't need a Roku. I'm saying, all right, I feel that other people understand my frustration. And those are people who fought and bled for this country. All right.
Really?
But the reason that we bring up all this mishigas is because Brian Tarantino, a character actor who played Jackie, the MC at the Gaslight Cafe on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, died this week at age 60. He was also known for his role as Bootsy on Gilmore Girls and was a guest on numerous TV shows, including The Sopranos and Law and Order. So a lot of New York shows. And also appeared in Spike Lee's movie last year, Black Klansman. And also a fixture on Broadway, Brian Tarantino, age 60. And what better way to honor him and to celebrate him than to learn that you are a fan of Marvelous Mrs. Maisel?
Yeah, I mean, watch the whole thing.
I will say this, that our plan, Lily and my plan, was we were going to be taking a long trip this holiday season, like 3 weeks at the end of the year. And one of our plans, when we are sequestered in snowy Washington, D.C., was to catch up on that show.
Well, you know, it's in, and normally I'm not a fan of shows dealing with stand-up comedy, because the stand-up portions always feel wrong. It feels like an actor's approach to what stand-up looks like. But this is one of the few ones, and it may be because it's set as a period piece. So the arched stand-up bits work as a throwback to a time when jokes were jokes, as opposed to, someone who's stand-up, because she's learning stand-up. So as an actor, she's doing very well as she learns the ropes. So it's a smart way to get around all these stand-up shows that I normally can't stand because it doesn't ring true, no matter how great. Like that Robert De Niro thing where he's an aging stand-up at the clubs. I even forget what that was called, but that's De Niro, and he can't even get the stand-up portion feeling right. So yeah, Maisel is one of the few.
But if he could, he wouldn't have had to kidnap Jerry Langford.
See what you did?
Yeah. I've told you before, right, that when Lily and I ever get a dog, we're going to name it Rupert Pupkin.
No, so, you didn't say that.
Back to Maisel. Door. Yeah, Maisel. Boy, they get the period right. And explore it in so many interesting ways, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's about women's rights and women's issues. The family dynamic. It works as a family sitcom, right?
Yeah.
A marital
and divorce.
Marital yeah. sitcom.
What is the '50s like? Being a single mom.
By the way, I was struck by rather delighted to realize that the movie playing at the theater where Lily and I got married right now is Marriage Story.
They just filmed the wedding, did they?
And yet Marriage Story is about a divorce. It's this generation's Kramer versus Kramer. Probably going to win Best Picture, I bet you.
No
so
way.
So we're not going to see it there because Lily thinks it would be bad juju, though I don't know if it would be for us or for the movie. I don't know what she's concerned about. But anyway, so, okay, good. Well, I will definitely catch up on Mrs. Maisel.
Report back.
I do love that cast, and it's just been about waiting. I dipped my toes in last Christmas, and because, you know, I had become reticent to avail myself of these things unless I knew they were going to last. But that has been off the mat now with me getting so involved with a couple of new shows, right? Evil on there on CBS. Great new network show already renewed for the second season. So my appreciation for it has been validated in the sense that I at least am assured a second season. I'm sure you've caught up now.
Really close to catching up.
And five episodes left of The Good Place. The experiment is over. We're going to learn in the coming week whether or not they saved humanity.
Oh my gosh, don't spoil it.
Well, I mean,
I'm caught up on that one.
All right. That's because where are you going to be able to scrape together 140 minutes to catch up on this season? Two hours and 20 minutes of...
You want some hair walk a Doberman puppy?
Oh, my God. You throwing a dog under the bus. Do you understand that there's two people who... There's three groups of people that watch TV regularly. One of them are dog owners. And this being America, the other is gun owners. And then there's those that own both dogs and guns. Okay. I don't even know what the hell I meant by that. That sounded so political, but it had nothing. It was just facts. Okay. I have really, very quickly, become so fond of HBO's Watchmen.
Oh yeah.
You know, we talked about this a little bit but the world building upon world building that they have done, because it's set decades after the events as I told you, in the Alan Moore graphic novel, after characters have slowly been introduced from that, but it's a whole new set of characters. And in that alternate version of the real world, exploring black and white race issues. In fact, a great line on this week's show when Regina King's character, Sister Knight, asks Tim Blake Nelson's detective called Looking Glass whether or not their boss, the chief of police, played by Don Johnson, in just a great performance.
Wow.
They're all great. I mean, everybody's just so phenomenal. But asked whether he thought, she asked Tim Blake Nelson whether he thought that their boss might actually be a racist. And Tim Blake Nelson responds with, "He's a white man in Oklahoma." And that's the whole answer. which is a great answer because Tim Blake Nelson is one as well in that,
right,
in that show. This show is, oh my God, it's great. Oh my God, it's everything you could want in a television show and more.
Wow.
Yeah.
Rarely do you wax so poetic on shows.
It is my new favorite show. It is.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean.
Okay.
Yeah. It has supplanted the Fargo. It has supplanted the Better Call Saul. I'm sure Better Call Saul will come back and then I will apologize. Awesome. I will apologize for being wayward. For being unfaithful to it. But it's that good. So good on you, HBO. Good on you, Damon Lindelof. And so I doff my cap to HBO, Dean, before I wag my finger at one of the worst television shows I've seen, the long-awaited series adaptation of Philip Pullman's novels, His Dark Materials.
Oh.
These are... such great novels. Are there better fantasy novels ever written than His Dark Materials? I would fight you if you said that there were.
It begins.
And I mean, so good. And in all the ways that the novels are good, this show is so failing. There was an attempt to adapt His Dark Materials, of course, into big screen motion pictures to take advantage of the audience that was proven by the success of the Harry Potter movies. And, you know, and that was why there were those adaptations of the Chronicles of Narnia. And for a variety of reasons and in a variety of ways, those films failed and they only got through three of the novels. The adaptation of the first book of His Dark Materials, The Golden Compass, certainly failed. It was a huge, huge budget. But it did some things right, namely casting. And what that first film did right, this series horribly does wrong.
Oh, no.
James McAvoy and Ruth Wilson, so miscast, so wrong on all ways for this. In every way you can imagine. Do they look the part? No. Do they embody the part? No. Are they just serving and functioning and servicing the plot? Yes. Which is not their either of their strong suit. You know, you need some stars who are able to service the plot while bringing an aura of mystery to it, which is why Nicole Kidman and Daniel Craig were very well cast in addition to looking the part in the original show. So it's suffering from casting. It's suffering from everything. You know, here's the thing that they do right that the original movie automatically failed in, which is it needs to be an episodic series, not a movie, because there's just too much to pack in and to unpack from these books to make them movies. They're that dense and that fascinating, and there's that much world building and that much thematic room for exploration. And all they are doing in this show is laying plot down. And every scene is about people discussing plot. That's it. Instead of letting us immerse ourselves in that world. And and that's the other thing. From a directing and a visual point of view, it's sometimes lovely to look at in terms of what they've invented and painstakingly created, but it's lovely to look at in the same way that the first two Harry Potter movies were fun to look at, but you never experienced the sense of being in that world until a real filmmaker came along, Alfonso Cuarón, with the third Harry Potter movie.
Right.
And
right.
So we're watching it. We're not immersed in it. We're not experiencing this magical realm in
right.
These dark materials. And so I'll just I'll put one final nail in the coffin. One of the key actors in the first couple episodes, played by Clark Peters, so good on The Wire, so good in so many things. In fact, impossible for him to be bad. Why, if he were bad in something, I would say you completely blame it on the hands of incompetent storytellers and not on the hands of the actor, because Clark Peters is that good. He's bad. He's very, very bad in this.
Bad. Just bad. So, plain old bad is bad.
So HBO's Watchmen, yes. HBO's His Dark Materials, black.
No. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. But it is an exciting time, Dean, where we're going to be heading into the season of self-congratulation.
Hey, I congratulate you for making it to the season of self-congratulation.
Some of the first nominations, the Gotham nominations came out for independent film, documentary awards there in New York were presented last night. So we're getting the first vestiges of the awards season. The first best of lists for the best of the decade have started to come out. Of course, critics will be revealing their top 10 lists for best films of the year by the end of this month, by Thanksgiving. And so it's always a very exciting time where all the various distributors are trying to get their award hopefuls out in front of the eyeballs, the right eyeballs, the opinion makers, the award deciders. So they can ride those nominated films to box office and ancillary glory, and the rest of those scores and scores of films that got shoved into theaters at the end of the year can disappear in ignominy. Is that the word?
Ignominy.
Yeah. Yeah. So a lot of movies, seeing a lot of movies. And again, as we've talked about, boy, Netflix is at the forefront of this year, even more so than last year. And I mentioned Marriage Story. Their Marriage Story is probably going to win Best Picture. And we talked about last week, their $180 million spectacle, The Irishman, the comeback, maybe the comeback of the decade, right? Eddie Murphy in Dolomite Is My Name. I saw another great Netflix movie this weekend that comes out in December called The Two Popes. And it's about the relationship between Pope Francis and his predecessor. For those of you who don't remember, it was only the second time in the history of the Catholic Church where a pope actually renounced the papacy to make way for a new pope. And quite an interesting friendship they had developed. And Francis is played by Jonathan Pryce, his predecessor, played by Anthony Hopkins. It's a masterclass in acting. It has no business being as funny as it is. It is such a witty and warm and delightful screenplay. And it's so refreshing to watch a movie and to say to yourself, this is such a well-directed movie.
Wow. That's very rare.
Fernando Murray, who did... one of my favorites, The Constant Gardener with Ralph Fiennes. And of course, last decade did the internationally acclaimed the world over City of God. So he's the real deal. And he makes this Two Popes so good. And a movie deserving to be seen on the big screen. And this brings us back to something that I wanted to discuss with you, which is the battle that is going on between theaters and Netflix right now. Theaters are so angry at Netflix for their short theatrical window prior to these films streaming. I think it's also residual anger over how, you know, Netflix has killed off the theatrical business. Although it was interesting, I was looking at the list of movies released this past decade. So many more, exponentially more movies released theatrically than any decade before.
Really?
In this country. Yeah. It's just
but that's because there are shorter runs, too.
Shorter runs, that's true. But what does that also mean? It also means that it's giving a wider array of movies an opportunity because there's so many fewer studio releases than ever before.
Oh, I see.
So,
but at the same time, yeah, but it's throwing spaghetti against the wall. They don't know what sticks. They're just getting everything out there because it's going to streaming so fast. Isn't that...
The ancillary. Yeah, I mean, that's true. But it means that counterintuitively, perhaps, theatrical is more widely utilized than ever before in terms of getting product out there. But I want to talk about this interesting position of the anger at Netflix. And you'll hear it, right? You'll hear Spielberg last year. Netflix shouldn't be... eligible for Oscars. They shouldn't be.
Right?
They're TV. That's what they are. TV. They're TV, says Spielberg.
You don't experience, movie.
Two things shut him up. One, them bankrolling Marty Scorsese's new movie, and them bankrolling Steven Spielberg's new movie. So those things shut Spielberg up toot sweet. But there is this kind of resentment, even among, you know, people in the industry. And I want to talk about that. Let's talk about that right now. Because, hello, theaters. Theaters are really using the occasion of The Irishman to vent their frustration with Netflix. And here is a movie at $180 million that as a theatrical release would lose everything. It would bankrupt whoever made it if they were banking on a theatrical release. Here's an idea. Let's make a $180 million 3.5-hour movie and have it star nothing but 80-year-olds.
Well, wait a sec. That's ageism right there. You have big talent. This is a giant epic. What you didn't like was just how it was executed. It wasn't about the age of the actors.
I'm not saying I didn't like it. I'm not saying anything. I'm saying that it would bomb. I'm not even being ageist. I'm saying it would bomb at the box office. That's what I'm saying.
Because there's no marketable names to it?
There's three 80-year-olds starring in it. You need $180 million, right? As opposed to like this terrible Edward Norton movie that Warner Brothers released, Motherless Brooklyn. And it's not his fault. He did probably as well with this as could have been done. But it's doing poorly at the box office. But a $25 million movie. So it's probably doing well enough that they won't lose money on it. It's a bomb, but they won't lose money on it.
Because they did their math beforehand.
To make The Irishman, to make it, I have no doubt that Scorsese needed to make it the way that he did, needed the money that he needed to make it. Okay.
Right.
In order for that to not lose money, it can't just be a hit. It needs to be a four-quadrant hit. Everyone needs to want to go to see it. Not everyone wants to see mobster movies. That eliminates an audience right there. Let's call that audience women.
This is not a
criticism of De Niro and Pacino, who do some fine work, but as I told you, I think your Oscar winner for Best Supporting Actor this year might be Joe Pesci. It's his career-topping performance. He comes out of retirement to give maybe his finest performance ever and one of the finest performances of the year. Speaking to anyone under 40 about this fact, the response is, Joe who?
Because he retired.
This is reality. This is just reality. It's not that younger people, it's not that different groups of people might not try the movie, but will they try the movie opening weekend, Dean, which is when they have to, so that it can keep theaters, so that it can play long enough, so that it can continue to generate revenues, i.e. the theatrical model? No. And whereas on Netflix, it stays. People can come to it. People can find it, right?
Right.
So
take their time.
So it's, there's a degree to which the theater chains and the theater business, again, need to look themselves in the mirror and say, look, there's been ample evidence that people want to have us show their product. And there's been ample evidence over the last couple of years that audiences want the theatrical experience. So what the hell do we need to start doing to make this viable and on a consistent basis again? And I don't think criticizing and getting angry at Netflix is the answer when you're angry that you don't get to show particular kinds of movies because Netflix is... You could show those Netflix movies, but you're angry at them because you're saying no to them. Not because they're saying no. They're saying we're going to stream it within a couple weeks, and that's making you say no. Okay, well, that's your decision, not Netflix's decision. And, hey, hats off to Netflix, by the way. I found out that, Marriage Story is playing in some theaters in New York, in L.A., for more than a month prior to it coming out streaming. All the theaters that their movies play in, they four-wall. They just rent them out. So the theaters, like the Egyptian Theater, the Vista that I mentioned, they get full freight the whole time, every screening that these movies are. Because Netflix is just four-walling them, just buying them out. And then they're not reporting the box office. But, you know, honestly, if you're doing that, why bother? Why bother reporting it?
Don't want it. That becomes also a marketing thing. Oh,
exactly.
This only did this many dollars.
Exactly. Right? Instead of, hey, this looks like it really could be good, instead of waiting a few weeks, let's go avail ourselves of it on the big screen. Or let's see the Eddie Murphy movie with an audience. We can always go back and watch it again. If it's really funny, we can watch it again in the comfort of our own home. Let's see Irishman on the big screen.
I'm all for this because for the longest time, theater houses have acted like gangsters. There's been a real, look, you know, the studio says you got to show this hit because we also have three dogs in the can behind it. So in order to see the big Star Wars, you got to show these other four ones. And then the famous players or AMC will then go, well, screw you. We are going to take 90% of the box office off the first weekend on the big one. But then we're taking 80% for the full month. And it becomes this antagonistic relationship between studios and movie houses and distribution companies. And I think back to Big Fat Greek Wedding that was renowned for making $300 million in however many weeks, but that Tom Hanks' production company, Playtone, had to sue the theaters to get that $300 million because the theater said, well, I doubt you're ever going to make another $300 million indie movie, so go fuck yourself. And they had to go to court to get their box office. So that kind of antagonism, that kind of gangster mentality, I think Netflix is just undermining all that, weakening their foundation, their ground from which they fight. And this is what really is the rage.
And let me just, you know, look, only Nixon could go to China. Only Phil can defend Netflix because I was ranting and raving last year, and I will again, the disappointment that I feel that more people are not given the opportunity to see these movies on the big screen, right?
Right.
I have no problem with movies being available in every manner the moment that they come out. Whatever business people want to do, they should live and be well. What I believe in, if you enjoy seeing movies on your phone, watch them on your phone. I just, some of these movies really deserve the opportunity to be seen writ large and, or to be seen in the communal experience, the sacred experience, right? And why do I call it sacred? I know that sounds so highfalutin, right? I've said before, the movie theater is my church. I was married in one, for crying out loud. But what makes something sacred is a sacrifice. That's what makes something sacred. That's the definition of it. And when you are going to be a part of an audience in that darkened collective space, you are making a sacrifice. You are sacrificing your ability to talk during the movie. You are sacrificing your ability to control your environment, control your surroundings. You are giving yourself and your control up to a communal experience. You are making that sacrifice, and the experience can therefore become sacred. It can be a magical, transformative experience that you cannot have watching in the comfort of your own home or on a phone. It doesn't mean you will have that experience, but it opens up all the possibility of it. And I just believe in the freedom of choice. I think, Netflix, you are making these movies that are worthy of this. And please, you've got to find a way in your bottom line that gives the entire country an opportunity to avail themselves of that experience if they so desire. And right now, still, you can see these great movies like you could see Ballad of Buster Scruggs on the big screen if you live in one of two cities, maybe three at most. And so that's my complaint. But But here's the folly to me of everybody being so upset about The Irishman being a Netflix movie. The rest of Hollywood refused to make it for 12 years.
Oh, really?
Nobody else would make it. I told you that. The De Niro, yeah. Since 2007, they were trying to get this made. And De Niro, Pacino, and Scorsese could not get backing for this movie. Until Netflix. And so why are you bitching and moaning about not having the opportunity to show movies you would want to show in theaters when literally no one will make them except the company you're angry at?
That's a great question. That, I think, is the very essence of where the problem lies. It's really short-sighted, frankly. You're going, don't show that product, but we don't make that product because we don't show that product. So, what? Yeah, that's ridiculous.
It really is. It's so anyway, I've seen a few of the other award hopefuls. One that I was really looking forward to, I mentioned, you know, Fernando Murray and the Two Popes and how wonderful it is to just see a film and go, wow, this is so perfectly directed. And that's a separate thing from, I'm not saying The Irishman is not wonderfully directed, obviously, but there's a degree to which when you see a film by an auteur like Scorsese, you're aware of Scorsese's presence throughout that movie. And here, it's not, oh, boy, that's a Fernando Murray flourish. That's a, you know, I can, as I've done, you know, in the past, I'm sure, go and find through lines between his movies. But it's just this piece stands alone and, oh, my, every choice is engaging me more and more fully with what I'm experiencing, what I'm watching, what I'm hearing. And that's great directing.
Right.
The other end of the spectrum would be someone like Jay Roach, who most probably successfully in theaters directed the Austin Powers movies. He's done some HBO movies like Recount that are quite effective. At best, we can say a journeyman director who has certain skills towards comedy. But nevertheless, I really was looking forward to what he would do with the story of Bombshell. Great title. And this is about the sexual harassment lawsuit that ended up bringing down Roger Ailes' tenure at Fox News.
Right.
And it stars Nicole Kidman as Gretchen Carlson, the woman who filed the lawsuit. Megyn Kelly as the star anchor at that time. This is taking place, of course, during the 2016 presidential election, where she spent a year getting in fights with the Republican frontrunner turned nominee turned president. And it stars also Margot Robbie in, unfortunately, a completely fictional role.
No.
And that's kind of a great place to start at why this movie doesn't work, is this idea that we want to explore certain thematic ideas, and the best way to do it is to have them embodied by a fictional character.
Well, yes and no, but we are also in the age of that didn't happen, that was inaccurate, you know, that you can't let facts get in the way of a good story, huh?
Well, but we are in this era of fake news, everybody deriding everything, and what a mistake, then, to make a movie where people will go, well, I can't trust what you did. A whole third of it is phony. You made it up. And I think, therefore, you need to be painstaking in your approach to this, especially when you have, in the case of Nicole Kidman, someone really well cast to tell this story, an important story, which is about how it's not just Fox News, for crying out loud. Hell, NBC had who was that guy who turned out to be just a sexual predator? The guy that hosted the Today Show? Matt Lauer. Yeah. And then NBC owns MSNBC. So there you go. You're on opposite ends of the political spectrum, and they're both. I like what Lee McCloskey said. Right, when you're on a boat, you're not worried about the left side of the boat or the right side of the boat. All you're worried about is that's an iceberg dead ahead.
Right.
And in this case, the iceberg dead ahead was rampant harassment and misogyny in the workplace, in all these workplaces, and the Boys Club of Broadcast Media. And So you've got a fantastic and a worthy story to tell, and something that could be really, really funny. And to top it all off, you have Charlize Theron. And is there a more adventurous movie star, really, right now than Charlize Theron, when you think about the range of roles she'll take on?
I know. For Monster, that was amazing.
Mad Max, Fury Road. And now this, which is, I hope wins her an Oscar, for best actress.
Really?
As Megyn Kelly, 8 different prosthetics pieces to be made to look like Megyn Kelly. And it is startling, the transformation.
Really?
And it's such a, but beyond that, it's such a great performance. She really, captures this. It's not an imitation. She captures a real person in a real story, which again leads us back to why then do we spend so much time watching someone who doesn't feel real, and then you find out after, it's not Margot Robbie's fault. She's doing as good a work as she can. It's just not grounded in verisimilitude because it's not.
Because so it stands out in floating away from any.
It's about dedicating something to an idea that we imposed upon what this material could have, and it's almost announced to me as a flaw in the beginning of the film, where it begins with Megyn Kelly with Charlize Theron narrating it and often turning and talking right to the camera, a la House of Cards.
Right.
And you think, okay, well, this is how it's going to be. She's going to guide us into this. She's going to do this. But then all of a sudden, Nicole Kidman's doing it once. And then another character does it once. So it's like, well, will everyone do it? No. After 25 minutes, no one does it ever again. It's just discarded as a device. Thank God, because it didn't work. But here's a thought. Discard it altogether then and redo that stuff. Or use something like that, because then there is a scene in the middle of the film where we suddenly get to hear the inner thoughts of a character. You know, you once. And,
cool.
And you know, you need to play by your own rules. We as an audience will go with you, no matter what the rules are, for the most part. But you need to play by your own rules that you establish.
Yeah.
And when you don't, they take us out of it.
Yeah. This sounds to me like too many chefs in the pot, really. If one person started with that conceit and then it's diminished down to just the first 25 minutes, that meant someone else took it, cut it out. Maybe there was more of it. And now it's a mess.
Yeah. And I think you have a director like Jay Roach where that's going to be the problem, because he does seem to be somebody who, let's face it, you cut your teeth on movies like the Wayne's World movies. I mean, not the Wayne's World, the Austin Powers movies. The main creative force is Mike Myers. I want to try this. I want to try this. I want to try this. Right?
Right.
This feels like something that Jay Roach said, here's a great idea to try, because that's where he comes from. This is a great idea to try. Let's try this. Let's just try this. But he's not someone who ever developed a forceful directorial point of view. And yes, film is a collaborative medium.
Mm-hmm.
And that collaboration works best, I would think, when the director has a strong voice, idea, concept to explore and has strong collaborators around to be able to say when the director says, hey, how about this idea, is able to say that's a good idea for another movie.
Right, right.
Stick to what you know is the heart of this, the core of this. Have that. It's Bombshell is an interesting mess as a result, because you see maybe the great movie it could have been and the greatness that's in it. And again, like I said, it's a worthy story, worthy of exploration, of course. And Charlize Theron is sure to be remembered at award time.
Excellent.
Hey, how about just how about we stop, actually, honestly? Let's stop.
This is a show.
And we'll get closer. I mean, we're stopping at an hour. We'll get into the practice of doing
that. Yeah, let's get into that practice.
All right. And we'll be back to talk about a whole bunch of documentaries and other movies. A lot of movies. In fact, I'm going to an IMAX screening, Dean.
Ooh.
Who doesn't go to IMAX? Me. This guy.
That guy right there. Okay.
I'm seeing The Lighthouse, the new black and white horror film from the maker of the great The Witch, one of the great horror movies of this decade. And he's got the black and white period horror film about two men isolated in a lighthouse. The two men played by Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe. And
holy shit! Yeah. I'm scared already.
Oh my God. Well, go watch the trailer. Immediately go watch the trailer. It's been out in theaters for a while. Go watch the trailer immediately.
Okay. I'm now hanging up on you to go watch the trailer.
Okay. And you'll be back next week with your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Find our show at chillpackhollywood.com. That's what we're going to say.
What we're going to do.
Or like us, facebook.com/chillpackhollywood.
We're still there.
And we're still on Twitter and Instagram.
Yep. We're at Dean and Phil. Yeah, to spell that out.
Because those are the places we're going to give the information of how to find us, where to find us, the links, and all that when we make this move on December 2nd. Until then, I'm Phil Larinus.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Guests of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn. Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.